Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Today's episode in our series on the history of bad ideas is about Facebook friends. I'm talking to the philosopher and writer Kathleen Stock, not just about Facebook friends, and in fact, not just about Facebook, but about the whole world of social media and what it has done to the idea of friendship, to human relationship, over the past couple of decades. This is a conversation about technology. It's a conversation about human relationships, but we also discuss some of Kathleen's personal experiences. Kathleen, we're going to talk about something which I am completely convinced is a bad idea. And at the same time, I don't actually really know anything about it firsthand because I am one of those people who has never, I wouldn't say never been on Facebook. I have been on Facebook in the sense I've occasionally found myself, but because I don't have a Facebook account, I've never actually experienced what it is like to be in the world of Facebook friends. So first of all, you're going to have to take me through it. But like I say, I've read quite a lot about it. And I think, like many people, I have quite a strong sense of the ways in which Facebook has shaped the information culture in the last 20 years. Let's do the personal experience first. So when did you first join Facebook and what was your initial feeling about the kinds of forms of human interaction it facilitated?
Well, I think I must have joined around 2006 because I remember that the first picture on my wall was a picture of me and my baby, and I can date it that way. But I joined because everyone else was joining.
And that's quite early.
I think we'd been softened up by something called Friends Reunited. I don't know if you remember that.
Do you remember it?
But that was really popular for a while, and it allowed you to go and spy on all your school friends, basically, because you put in your school in your year and it would group people together, and then you could find out what happened to people. And that was fascinating.
It's like the reunion without having to go to the reunion.
Yes, exactly.
Which is everyone's dream. I want to go to the reunion without anyone being able to see me.
Exactly. So I knew that I had enjoyed that. When I say enjoy it, I mean just for that function only, but obviously it's diminishing returns once you find out what happened to everybody. Then Facebook arrived and I joined that. And I pretty quickly thought it was incredibly weird how people were interacting on there. Yeah, I did.
And what was the initial feeling of weirdness? I mean, was there a period before the weirdness where you thought, this is nice, I can share pictures with people that I know? Was there ever a moment where you thought, oh, I can see this?
I mean, I assume that this was before they introduced all the extra algorithms that kind of made it even more
evil,
unhealthy. But right from the start, I was aware that it was changing the way that friends, as in existing friends, normally interacted, because you were almost always interacting in front of somebody else. And even if you, or at least you thought you were, because of course you don't know who's looking, but there's the possibility in every interaction, apart from private ones, of being looked at by your other friends. And I think at that point, no one had worked out how to do the settings either to make it, you know, even semi-private. So, and I don't think anyone wanted to either. I think we were naive. So there was a lot of like, oh, wow, the world can see me talking to my friend. And that's, some people seem to really like that. So as I think I've mentioned, I've written about this once, and I mentioned that quite early on, I saw a husband and wife, academics, that had just got married. And I knew that they were in the same house because you could see talking to each other over Facebook on the public walls of each other.
Knowingly,
yes. And, you know, quite affectionately, like, hello, darling, that was a lovely grapefruit you carved for me this morning or something. And I was like, what the bloody hell is going on here? Like, why can't they just say that to each other? Or we did have phones back then. We could have texted, you know, each other these very same thoughts. But there's something really seductive about wanting to do it in front of other people. And I could see that was going to mess things up.
Because the original dystopian thing was, oh my God, there are people in the same house and they're texting each other rather than talk. I can remember that, like a kid on the sofa texting to someone in the next room, and that was thought to be the end of civilization. And as you're just saying it now, they could have done that, the normal thing.
They could have done that. And I actually think texting is fine. I don't think there's much pathology associated with texting. In fact, it might even have increased communication in a good way because it's just so easy and it's interpersonal, and it also kids are learning spelling, you know, things like that through it.
Sort of, yes.
Spell check anyway. But, you know, Facebook was totally different because of this additional third eyes on you. And I did French at university. I'd read Huis Clos by Sartre. You know, the whole point of that, which is called No Way Out, I think, in English, is that these three characters are stuck in hell, and hell is constantly being watched by a third person when you're trying to have a one-to-one interaction with the other person, you know, in the trio. You're never alone to directly just sort of have that kind of one-to-one conversation. There's always someone overlooking you. And it brings out lots of emotions, I think. Just that fact, like, people feel shame so much quicker on social media than they would in a one-to-one reaction because they're anticipating the potential or actual reactions of people looking on. Even actually, I remember early on thinking, wow, I felt anxiety when I would post something and no one would interact with it, which you just wouldn't feel if you just texted someone and they hadn't replied, unless you really cared. But it was that feeling of like being left visibly hanging, that suddenly you can project into the void all these extra negative emotions. So I could see that people were acting kind of anxious and ashamed and belligerent and showing off a lot, obviously. So it's a great vehicle for narcissists. So that was all, I could see that coming.
So you could see it coming.
Ah, I participated.
So I was going to say, so Sartre says it's hell. This is a version of hell. And yet you've described the academic couple performing in a way that makes it sound like this is the thing they'd always dreamed of, that they could perform their marriage in front of an audience. And this is early in the Facebook story, so we're going to come on to sort of some of the ways this has morphed into things that may be even worse than that. But in the early version of it, did it feel like a slippery slope, or did you just think, oh, people are a bit weirder than I thought because this ought to be a version of help, but some of them are really enjoying it?
Yes. I'm not so moralistic that I think it's terrible for everyone to do that. I can see it just wasn't very good for me. Because there are some people who just take to it like a duck to water. They never seem to utter a thought that they don't express on Facebook still. And there are other people that just don't think that hard about it and would think that I'm, you know, massively overthinking it. But I don't think I'm wrong that you could see anxiety ramping up. You could also see arguments. Like, it was very strange to be watching arguments on people's walls between, I suppose it's either... So Facebook friends is in inverted commas, obviously, because most people are not your friends. They're just sort of randoms. At that point, that's another point. People were just kind of stacking up numbers, accepting everybody that friend requested you without any kind of filter. And particularly in academia, weirdly, I think because everyone was sitting around on their computers all day anyway, but like postgrads were asking, colleagues from different universities were asking. If you'd met someone once in the coffee queue, they were asking. Suddenly you were like, oh, I've got 300 Facebook friends. I must be popular. So, but they're not really friends. And then I suppose the technology also allowed what used to be disparate real friend groups suddenly to be all together in a virtual space, interacting with each other. And that can cause friction. Obviously, it can cause anxiety if you present a different persona to different friend groups, and suddenly, you know, what do? They're all together watching you talk. So I think that's an interesting aspect of it.
As you said, one of the things that makes it chilling is the way in which an experience which you don't have in the offline world, which is of communicating into the void. I mean, in a sense, offline, it's quite hard to recreate the experience of saying something. I mean, it's close to some people's public speaking nightmare. You know, some people have bad dreams where they imagine they get up on stage and 300 people are watching and they say something and the audience sort of turns their back on them. But it never actually happens in real life, I think, on the whole, whereas it happens all the time online. So I've just read a novel, an interesting, quite sort of a fashionable novel just published a couple of months ago by Nathan Hill called Wellness, which is one of the great American novels of this year as it's being promoted. A story of a couple and the way in which their marriage has gone wrong. But in this story, there is a chapter about the husband's father, estranged father, who has turned in the course of this book into a kind of online conspiracy crazed person, following and liking and believing all sorts of crap. And the son is he doesn't like his dad, but he can't understand what happened to him. And in the novel, you get, I'm assuming, a pretty well-researched account of, it's a chapter in Seven Algorithms, of the seven algorithms that this old man passes through that turn him from someone who is basically living an isolated life on a farm somewhere in the Midwest to the hub of all sorts of conspiracy theories. And the way it's described is that the Facebook algorithms, initially, their purpose is just to get you to spend more time on the network and on the platform. And the way to do that with people who are new to it is to artificially boost everything that they do. So that for the first 6 months, this old man who has no friends and is pretty alienated, his loneliness falls away as he discovers that his most banal thoughts get liked by people and appear first on other people's walls. And somehow, artificially, he's given the impression that there is a world out there that cares about what he thinks. It's not true, because everything that he thinks has been given a massive boost by Facebook. And then after 6 months, he reaches a threshold where he moves off that algorithm and his feed is managed by a different algorithm, which no longer needs to boost him. And he suddenly finds that everything that he says gets no response. And this plunges him into a feeling of despair and depression. And the new algorithm is designed not to boost what he says, but to find what he's interested in and then connect him to groups that have similar interests. But because he's so anxious and lonely, he starts throwing out ideas in the hope that someone will pick up on them. And immediately the new algorithm then starts constructing a persona for him. And the implication of this chapter is that the technique is roughly based on those sort of guides to dating for pickup artists. I was going to say angry young men or older men, where first of all, there's lots of sort of complimenting and this and that. And then suddenly you go cold and you neg the person and you try and engender a sense of desperation, out of which you get a neediness which you can manipulate. Now, I was persuaded by this novel that this is the business model. Is that how it's experienced when you're on the other end? Because I don't know.
I didn't know of that one, that algorithm. I did know of other basic ones, like, and you can see them on across all social media, really, but strong emotions seem to travel fast, as it were. So you get much more interaction for saying something strongly negative or strongly positive. But either way, they seem to go further. There's also just the fact that it picks up on a kind of animal impulse, or I don't know what you call it exactly, but that we, if we knew every day that at 6 o'clock someone would comment on our Facebook wall, we probably wouldn't check. And that we know that they wouldn't the rest of the day. We would only check at 6:05. But because you don't know at any point, so there's kind of a sporadic reward, basically, you keep checking. And most of the time, you're not rewarded. There's nothing you want to see. But occasionally, there's something really exciting that happens on Facebook, especially if you're younger, you're looking for social connection or romantic connection. So then, you know, I've had this explained to me that pigeons, if you give them feed very regularly through some kind of contraption, everything's fine. But if you just give them a bit of feed randomly, they'll peck themselves to death trying to get in or to make the contraption move, because, you know, so that I thought that was a rather chilling kind of piece of information about our basic, it's probably to do with, like, you know, being on the savannah or something, but our basic drives are gamed by these platforms, our drives for connection, our drives for reward, and so on, dopamine responses. So that's all pretty chilling. I think you have to learn how to manage yourself on these platforms if you're going to stay there. And people who can't manage should just get off. And it's not their fault, but, you know, there's clearly some people who are just not suited. One thing that annoys me, just to say about the conspiracy theory aspect, is that, you know, they did produce some conspiracy theorists, but they also allowed a lot of, I don't know, patrician academic elite types to say, oh, that everything, you know, it's all a conspiracy theory, and to really look down on people who want to know the truth about how politics works or do support Donald Trump for reasons that are okay, you know, and it allowed this narrative to emerge really quickly that, oh, these are just stupid people who's had their brains hacked by the algorithms. And I think that was also a terrible result.
Because it is also the case that Facebook has many positive features, right? I mean, I'm aware, and again, as someone who's not used it, that one can believe that this is the source of all of the problems in the world. And, you know, I've read Mark Zuckerberg's manifesto in which he gives the positive side, and I know that that's an implausible and somewhat rose-tinted version of it. But there is a version of connectivity which has been made possible by these platforms, in which people find like-minded people for good reasons and with positive benefits. And that's still true, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure everything has a good side and a bad side. And so it allows you to keep up with family and friends and to know what's going on in their lives that you wouldn't otherwise know unless you're very diligent. It also allows you to meet, I suppose, in the groups and the sort of the add-ons like special interest groups, hobby groups and things like that. It allows you to interact with people to show, if you've got a hobby, you can take photos and show your quilt or the thing, you know, your painting. You can get lots of likes. But of course, you can then get anxious if you don't get enough likes, or you can get into an argument with someone in the quilting group about social justice. So that's why you've got to be a strong-minded person, I think, to be able to deal with this. And it's not for everybody. I think that's true. And we shouldn't really be letting kids do it, I don't think.
And it's part of the illusion here that it presents as benign and it presents connectivity as a positive thing. And as you've described it, actually, it's not just that it's not for everyone. It's quite a test of some of your basic human social attributes to be able to cope with it. So this isn't just something that you need to be a bit wary of. Actually, probably for quite a lot of people, it's not a good thing. And yet there is an assumption here that, you know, we're all for connectivity. We're all kind of for friendship. The odd thing about the social media age is that it's presented as something that kind of goes with the flow of human communication and human experience. It's an enhancement. And actually, on the whole, you have to be quite careful, and it's something that only works in a relatively narrow range of circumstances. It's not the default. It's presented as the default, and it's not.
I mean, I think it's a complement to your normal life, but you can't use it as a replacement for friends. I mean, most of these people are not real friends. If you don't know them in any other context but Facebook, then I would say they're not real friends. And you've got to hang out with your friends in real places and have real experiences, multi-sensory experiences. So I think it would be bad for a person if that's all they had. I also think it's quite a sophisticated technology, and it's got a lot of power. It's got power for good, it's got power for bad, and it would be naive to think that it didn't have power for bad. So for instance, when it's just been plonked in a country which is wholly unready for it or has a different culture, like Myanmar, for instance, it can have devastating effects because people don't understand how to use it at first, or they don't have other means of communication. So they start using it all the time. They don't know how to filter out certain bits of information that we would just automatically filter out, and so on. So, and that's not because they're stupid, obviously. I mean, we would have the same trouble were we some kind of system of communication from Myanmar to be imported here, we wouldn't understand it. But I don't think any of that was particularly cared about by the people that started it. I think they just thought, oh, it will benevolently seed the world with happy groups of friends communicating nicely to each other.
Do you think any of the problem stems from how it actually started? So the origin of the origin story is Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm in Harvard wanting to rank women, basically, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, or whatever it was. And then this is the social network version of the story, but I think it's broadly true. And sort of discovering that he'd stumbled on a kind of goldmine. And then it has to be presented as something else. It's not
it's
like
profit. It's entirely for profit. I don't believe the altruistic stories that accompany it. It comes from Silicon Valley, so of course they would have to have altruistic stories to accompany it, but I don't believe them. And you can see as well in the way that they've dealt with being very too slow to get to tackle child trafficking on the site, because it's for all these hobby groups about quilts, there are other groups with paedophiles, you know, passing around information and stuff like that. It had that potential very early on. I'm sure they could have seen that coming. It's not in their interests, particularly unless forced to worry about that so much, as long as they're just building engagement and building engagement. And that seems to be what they focus upon.
The one person I know who worked at Facebook at a reasonably high level said the only two rules real rules inside the building. There were lots of fake rules. If you had a new product, a way you wanted to tweak the design of the platform, the two questions you had to ask were, will it lead to people spending more time on the platform? Yes, good, no, bad. And then the second question was, will Mark like it? Yes, good, no, bad. And it is true of these companies that promote connectivity and a sort of rose-tinted vision of democracy, basically, which is if people can communicate more and speak more and exchange more, they will understand better. It's always struck me one of the profound ironies of the world that we live in is that the companies that make this stuff are deeply autocratic. Mm. I mean, they are basically dictatorships, tyrannies. I don't know. They're like these tech titans are like pharaohs or something. Are these gods at the top of these? And the companies are set up to empower them in this way. It's very, very hard. If this was a leader of an autocratic state, we would say, my God, this person is behaving like a kind of medieval king. And that is true of the structure of these companies. And there's this unbelievable mismatch between how they operate internally and what they project.
I'm sure that's true. It's very strange to think one of the real rules is, would Mark like it? I mean, he just seems such a strange person in every interview I've ever seen. I did watch him recently because he's saying that the real technology, we should say that Facebook is very old fashioned now and hardly anybody that's cool goes on it. And it's...
Indeed. I was going to say that. I didn't think I was the person to say it because I've never been on it.
It's an absolute mess when you go on now because there's so many adverts and they're always constantly trying to sell you new things that or make you watch things. If you watch one thing for more than 3 seconds, like a cooking show in my case, your eyes linger for more than 3 seconds. Then next thing you know, they're just chucking every possible cooking show at you. And you've got to filter all that out in order to find the post from your friends about, you know, their families or whatever. So, but no, the new technology is that they... He wants, I don't know if it's really you could roll it out at scale, but he wants to scan every bit of your face basically and produce this incredibly immersive 3D experience where it seems like you're talking to someone in the same room and it's very, very similar to that experience. It's not like it's uncannily so. But at the same time, he's saying things like, you know, if you're not happy with your face, we can tweak your face and we can make you look better looking and we can make you smile more. And again, there's that sort of, it sounds good up to a point because, of course, it replaces, it's environmentally friendly and all the rest of it. But he's also saying that we can bring in AIs and they can have their own sort of faces. So you can be talking to an AI and you can be talking to your friend in California and it can seem like you're in a room with 3 people. This sounds to me like J.G. Ballard or something, but he thinks it sounds wonderful. You know, he just thinks it sounds cool. So
I think one of the oddities about him is, so he had this idea in his dorm in Harvard to rank girls that he was sort of, you know, it was a little power play. And then by a kind of miracle, it morphed into an idea that could be the basis of a very successful business. So good luck to him. I'm sure that happens in America and in other places too. You have some weird idea and it turns into something very profitable. And then quite early on in the story, people wanted to buy out Facebook. And a lot of his early investors said to him, I think Yahoo offered them $1 billion. And Peter Thiel, who's meant to be this kind of guru in Silicon Valley, who was on the early board of Facebook, said, you should sell. Like, it's $1 billion. And you know, how big is this thing going to get? And Zuckerberg was the person who said no. And of course, he was right. So that's the first point at which he thinks he has a kind of insight that other people lack. And then a few years later, he decided to buy Instagram when I think it employed 19 people. And it was this tiny platform. And I can't remember what he paid for it, but it was a multiple of its earnings beyond anything that made any sense to anyone at all. And the business press said he's lost his mind. Like he's paying, this is a sort of symbol that this bubble is out of control. He's paying way over the odds for this picture sharing platform. And it now generates more than a third of Meta's total revenues. So second time, he thinks the world is wrong and I'm right. So, and maybe 3 times, because in Harvard, you know, everyone was being horrible to him and he thought I'm right. And so there is a kind of guru thing going on here. And so with the metaverse, I don't know what's the point at which, if you have that set of experiences...
You think I've made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, when do you admit you've made a mistake?
Your investors and your board, presumably.
But the board were telling him first time round, sell to Yahoo. And he said, no, and the company, I believe, is set up so that he can never be outvoted on the board. So there is something quite weird going on here in terms of his psychology, in that this thing, you know, you say it's odd that Will Mark like it, but actually that really is the question in that company.
I mean, he's obviously had his finger on the pulse. I can't say, I mean, I'm not suggesting people won't like it necessarily. I'm suggesting it'll be terrible. And those are different things.
Those are different things.
But I mean, one thing that we haven't really discussed is how people get more and more extreme. I suppose we have a bit with the conspiracy theorists, but I have seen it in real time through sort of debates that I engage in on both sides. People, once you start getting validation for a certain kind of content or position, and again, it relates back to doing it in public, it seems to become very hard for people to change their minds. Because they've committed themselves in public so many times and also started to get, in some cases, a following for it or lots and lots of validation. So then it's sort of solidified polarization, quite obviously. I mean, this is maybe a banal thing to say, but I do think it's one of the worst things about it is it's a bit like in academia, you know, when you've written a paper on an argumentative paper on something and then you have to write something else that fits with what you said 5 years ago, or at least you feel you should. Even if you think it was a load of rubbish, you know, like it's an oeuvre, you've got to get out there and say something that fits with it. And I think everyone's going through a version of that now. It's like, well, I can't disagree with my former self. I, you know, especially when I expressed myself so vociferously at the time.
Not least because disagreeing with your former self is taken as a sign of hypocrisy, which is the great sin in this
which
world.
Is ridiculous. I've always found that very annoying. I mean, that's not just on social media. That's in kind of a private eye or whatever, you know. They just won't let people have different opinions from their former selves without laughing at them.
Yeah, flip-flopping is the great sin and sincerity is the great virtue. When did sincerity
I don't think flip-flopping and sincerity are is the right opposition. It's flip-flopping and being very fixed in your position, and that can be a terribly bad thing. You know, it can be literal mindedness, stubbornness, and those are not necessarily good things.
Do you think Elon Musk is right? So Twitter is also completely under his control now. Part of his pitch when there were the Threads Twitter wars going on, whenever it was last year, you know, the idea that Mark Zuckerberg was going to offer a nicer version of Twitter on Threads, which to me, Threads is a really sinister name because it's the name of that TV show in the 80s about what life will be like after a nuclear apocalypse. And it's the scariest program that's ever been made. I don't think they show it now. It's too frightening. Anyway, but Mark Zuckerberg's version was, it's the kind of Instagram Twitter. So it's nice and it will be validating. And Twitter, Elon Musk said, at least forces you to sort of face a version of reality.
I think that is true, actually, on two counts. So if you compare Facebook to Twitter, there's something strange about Facebook's kind of semi-private, or the kind of conceit that you're speaking in semi-privacy. Obviously, you can set your settings so that the world can see you, but still they'd have to find you. I don't know how the algorithms work exactly, but they don't, you know, your public content doesn't just automatically go to everybody in the same way. It just goes to your friends. And so this allows, I've found particularly relevant to my sort of life experience, that groups of Facebook friends who are not really friends, but, you know, just colleagues, say academic colleagues, for instance, can defame and malign you under the sort of pretense that this is just a discussion amongst friends. Whereas if they did that shit on Twitter, then people could see it, they could argue with it, you know, so it allows bubbles much more easily to develop where people's views aren't challenged because they're like-minded or because it's just somehow harder to challenge people that you're sort of socially connected to. Whereas on Twitter, you could challenge strangers all the time about their views and strangers can challenge you. Of course, it makes it a lot more sort of rambunctious and offensive in many cases, but it does keep you more honest that way. And then all this nonsense about the nice version of Twitter. Every now and again, there's a kind of exodus of people, of nice people from Twitter saying, you know, follow me on Blue Sky or follow me on Threads or whatever it is. That's where the nice people are going. It really makes me want to vomit. I can't think, because I know now that people aren't very nice, and particularly the people that say they are nice are usually amongst the most horrible. So I just imagine that they're all being passive aggressive over there, and I'd much prefer where I am.
given, as you put it, your life experiences in recent years, have you found on Twitter? So you're on Twitter quite a lot.
I am, yeah. Yes.
And do you find it liberating? I mean, in the sense that you've been subject to an awful lot of abuse and groups of people, criticism, abuse, and groups of people using criticism of you as a way of validating themselves within the groups to which they belong. When you engage with that kind of thing on Twitter, is there a sense that you have a kind of, I don't know, agency or ability to be yourself that you don't have on the other platform?
Oh, I never, you see, I don't go on, I mean, apologies to all my Facebook friends, my real friends, but I don't really go on Facebook anymore. I have real friends there and I don't take people I don't know. I never talk politics. I just look at pictures of babies and dogs and like catch up with what people are doing. I never really engage with what people are saying. Like, I don't write anything. Twitter I use professionally because it gets my writing out there and the stuff that I'm doing. But do I find it liberating? No, not really.
What do you get from it, apart from getting your stuff out there?
That's a good question. Not a lot. I take it off my phone when I don't have to use it. I don't look at it unless I have to use it. But, you know, a lot. I do write regularly now for national publications and they want me to put that out, you know, so, and it helps. But these people, though, that you're talking about that really either dislike me or my views, they've all blocked me. So I never see them and they never see me. So that's a version of a bubble where you just block everybody who disagrees with you or that you think are somehow going to contaminate you through the screen by their presence on the same platform.
When you said that you want to throw up at the thought of the nice version of these things because you've discovered, or maybe we already knew, that people aren't that nice. When you think about Facebook friends, which is the bad idea we started with here, does it reveal something about us? So part of what we've been talking about is it reveals something about Facebook as a company, as a money-making machine. I don't know how much of it is malign. I think a lot of it is just thoughtless, unthinking. You know, it's some of it is just baked into the structure of a particular kind of organization. It turns out this technology can do things to people without anyone really intending it and have terrible consequences. On the other hand, it sometimes feels that this technology has revealed things about who we really are. Is the bad idea here that it's tapping into something about us that is better kept unpoked by whatever that stick is?
I mean,
is?
I think I always did think that the status of the language, to get pretentious, is quite unusual because it's not like a letter or even an email where you might, you know, spend quite a lot of time composing it and it's to one person, as we've described, it's going to be looked at by other people as well. And it's very direct and you've got it on your phone and you can just do it with your thumbs or you could just type, 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 and it can be like off the cuff, badly phrased. And it's a bit like speech in that way, that there's a very short distance from thought to expression. I mean, it's not quite like speech, but for some people who don't speak to people anymore very much, that's their main way of just reacting, type, 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 you know, and you don't do that in an email. You at least have 5 minutes. So it gives us insight into people's inner lives in a way that we never had before, because they are just splurging them in front of you. The first thought they had often is the thing that you read, and you wouldn't get that except through quite a lot of intimacy with somebody, like living with them or, you know, knowing them really well. So yeah, it hasn't always shown the best of what's going on inside people's minds, I think, in terms of traditional vices, you know, jealousy, envy. So when it's called social media, obviously the social encompasses the nice stuff, but shame is a social emotion, envy is a social emotion, resentment is a social emotion. You only get them in groups or interpersonal relationships. You don't feel shame on your own unless you're projecting someone. And you don't feel envy of, you know, an inanimate object. It has to be somebody else. So all of that got opened up. Those boxes got opened up, I think.
I can remember, this is maybe 15 years ago. So we've been talking a bit about what this does to academics. And this was someone who'd been an MP. I think he was a man of about 70 at this point. He'd been an MP, an MEP. He was then an academic of some kind, and he was also a journalist. So he'd really been in the world. But he was a man of 70, so it had been a fairly protected version of the world. And for the first time in his life, he had looked below the line at one of the articles that he'd written in The Guardian. So this is, you know, and The Guardian sometimes is notoriously the worst place to look below the line. And he was really haunted by this experience. And you could tell that he had been thinking, it was a few days after he'd done it, and he obviously forced himself to read all the way through, that he had no idea people were like this. He'd been a politician, so he knows that people, he knows it's a combative world, and he knew that, you know, arguments provoke counterarguments. I think the two things that he hadn't appreciated was how random people's responses are, their visceral responses to what you write. It's got nothing to do with what you write. You know, it's just you're, and it's that feeling that it would be like walking down the street, and as you pass someone, the thought that you provoke in their head is actually, you can hear it, and then the next person, the next person. And he looked like he'd come back from the Battle of the Somme. I can still remember it. And I remember both thinking, my God, it must be a very protected life to be an MP if this can really shock you. And also thinking, it must be really bad below the line in The Guardian, because this man, you know, he's not some wallflower.
Well,
right?
You hear of people who come undone by getting obsessed with the comments. Like there was an influencer on Instagram who ended up, so there's a whole other social media site called Tattle Life that I'm sure your listeners have never heard of. It's a mostly female used big website where you get to gossip about influencers and pop stars and, well, I'm not sure about pop stars, but people on the telly basically and influencers. And you can say pretty much whatever you like about them. You can say, oh my God, did you see what Stacey Solomon was doing? And, you know, it's just really bitchy. It's like the taking bitchiness and gossipiness and just making it the whole point. And this one influencer was obviously could not stay away from reading the thread about her, and then got a persona and pretended to be someone else and started bitching about other influencers, and then got found out and her whole career was destroyed. You know, it's just this kind of Shakespearean drama going on. Or on Goodreads, you know, authors who go in and start arguing with people on Goodreads. So it just underlines the point, you've got to be quite strong to go there. And if you can't do it, don't do it. Because the other thing to say is it's ephemeral. It's not like an email. It's not like a book. It's ephemeral. On one level, it stays there forever. But on the other level, nobody reads it again. It's just they're too busy reading the next thing. So you can know that, you know, people be fulminating about what I wrote today on Unheard under the line or on Facebook somewhere. And tomorrow they'll be fulminating about something else. And there'll be no memory of, you know, who can remember what happened last week on social media?
The bitchiest site I've ever seen is one called Political Science Rumors. I don't know if it still exists, but it certainly used to exist. And it was gossip about academic jobs. So there's the single most boring topic in the world, which is who's going to be appointed, yeah, to a kind of assistant lectureship at this place. And it was anonymous. I mean, it was just like a sort of recipe for the worst of what it is to
be
human.
There was one called the Meta Blog. I'm just revealing that. I used to read it. It got shut down eventually, but it was philosophy postgrads, all of whom, you know, most of whom cannot get jobs, who have just spent 4 years doing esoteric PhDs, racking up tons of debt, and are now stuck age 32 while their friends who didn't do PhDs get real jobs. So they are full of poisonous feelings. And then there was this anonymous blog where they could just bitch, slander, defame, mock philosophers, academic philosophers who had jobs. Or there's a certain catharsis in reading it, was, I have to say.
I remember once being told by someone that if you arrive in a town and you don't know anyone and you want to find the worst behaved people, go to the university, ask for the philosophy department, go to the philosophy department and ask for the ethicists.
Yeah, that's very true. No, but they're all on Threads.
So given what you've been through in the last few years, is the ephemerality of it any consolation? I mean, I don't know, I don't know what your coping mechanisms were, but, you know, a lot of it took place on these platforms. Have you found yourself able to take some comfort from the thought that this is superficial?
I mean, for a start, I've never really done anything on social media myself. Maybe a few exceptions, but, you know, I don't go off and attack people for no reason, despite what is said about me. It's the other way around. So it's non-ephemeral enough, I'm afraid, if somebody's really made a big effort to destroy my reputation online and I know it's still there. You know, I remember it. I've got over it, you know. Well, no, I haven't got over it, but I just think I'm going to get my revenge someday on particular people who really defame me online. And these are all academics. Yeah.
It's amazing how much this conversation has been about the behavior of academics.
I really think social media does something weird to their brains, and it's because they're not very social people, and they're not very, a lot of them are not very socially adept. Suddenly, there's this whole world, and it's very enticing to them.
Academia used to be a lonely profession. That was part of the point. You signed up knowing it wasn't actually the place to make hundreds of friends.
But there's also, it's always been a place also where narcissism can flourish in front of students, you know, and you can get certain personality types attracted to it. And people like to pontificate. And now, and you know, thank God Twitter has character limits, but Facebook doesn't. So you can just give your opinion on this, that, and the other and call it work even maybe, or call it brainstorming with colleagues and address it up in your mind when it's really not that at all.
And academics have traditionally been pretty snooty about journalists. You've sort of crossed that line. My experience is that journalists are much more aware of the power of words than academics.
Yeah, that figures. Well, they're not very, I mean, I'm talking about only about philosophers now, academic philosophers, because I don't really know enough. I don't read widely in academia anymore. But, you know, they're not wordsmiths. Most of them. They're not actually very good writers. They're literate and they've understood a technical vocabulary that they can then use, but they're not really that concerned with clear communication or, I don't know, you know, I mean, I think this fits with your analysis there.
To go back to where we started, as you said, Facebook friends, it's a bad idea. It feels like a bad idea with hindsight. I'm not sure that the people who came up with it were bad people, but some bad ideas take hold and the people who are responsible for them don't do enough to remedy the harm that they're doing. But like you said, no one's on Facebook anymore. The money is coming in other ways. I mean, I say no one's on Facebook anymore. It's a global phenomenon, and actually, and in some countries, it is the route to the internet. In order to get to the internet, you have to go via Facebook. And the phrase Facebook friends feels quaint. I mean, friends reunited sounds like something from the Victorian era, and Facebook friends sounds like a sort of the Edwardian version of that. But what do you think it has done to the idea of human friendship? Because, you know, it did colonize that word, and friendship is an important...
I think it's a bit like seahorses aren't horses, Facebook friends aren't friends. I mean, I think it's used the word, but it hasn't done actually anything directly to friendship, in the sense that these were not friends anyway, unless you had some alternate route to relationship with them. I remember thinking at one point, because I had all these academics as Facebook friends, and then I would go to conferences and I'd be seeing their content every day. I would be seeing their inner thoughts every day. And then we'd stand together in the coffee queue and we wouldn't acknowledge each other. And I thought, this is really weird, you know. And then I thought, well, I can't have it. That's exactly what I thought. I can't have anyone on my Facebook friends list that I wouldn't say hello to
in a coffee queue.
That's gonna be a bare minimum.
It's quite a low bar.
and then I gradually upped it over time. But yeah, I don't think it's done anything directly. But what it has clearly done for some people is give them and this is the positive version, you know, give them a way to stay in touch with people that they are really friends with, and family as well. That's the other aspect. It really does allow you to keep in touch with extended family and know what's going on in their lives in a way you wouldn't do, I think, most of us these days, because we're not, families are dissipated across geographical space. But I think also equally for younger generations, social media has, some of them anyway, it's a kind of like synthetic substitute for friendship. And if you do find real social interaction difficult, you can kid yourself you're having it in the virtual world, and that's not very good if you're a teenager and you're not leaving your bedroom. You've got lots and lots of friends, in inverted commas, who are giving you lots of validation for whichever feelings you're having right now. And they can be quite destructive feelings, you know, or disturbing feelings, but you're not really getting out there in the world to test yourself against reality enough. And that would be another real problem. And for them, I think it's probably has done something to the notion of friends. A lot of kids have not had a chance these days to meet the real version before they meet the online version.
In the same way that your early experience of it was quite quickly to be suspicious of this, and these habits change quite quickly for everybody. I mean, everyone has an early experience of these platforms, and often it's positive, and then you see the darker side. And many people are abandoning Facebook in droves. I mean, where does this go from here? I mean, presumably what you've just described for younger people is something that they also will be recognizing in their experiences of the world.
Yes. I think perhaps an optimistic note, despite what I said about some young people. So I was talking about reasonably small numbers of young people who I think have been kind of terribly damaged by social media, by being exposed to it too early and using it as a substitute for real experiences with people. But there's also a healthy contingent, I think, of younger people these days who are over it, basically. Maybe partly in reaction to the way that their parents' generation, which is my generation, are still slaves to it. You know, I mean, it's middle-aged people who can't get off their phones. We're all trying to ban it for younger people, but I wouldn't mind if they banned it for us. It was exciting when it arrived, but it's not exciting now. It's naff. And also, clearly, it has the possibility for humiliation, which I think young people are very attuned to, or should be attuned to. So I think I'm told that like quite a lot of kids aren't using it at all, or they're using different technologies that aren't really that interactive. I mean, TikTok, for instance, people go on and on about how awful TikTok is, but most people, when they download TikTok to their phone, they just look at stuff. They don't put their own content out there. Facebook always kind of required you to put your own content out there and to kind of have a pseudo interaction that way. So there are, and Instagram, you can just kind of scroll through pictures, basically, is all you're doing most of the time, pictures and words. I've got Instagram. I never write anything, but I watch. So it's turning us into voyeurs instead, but never mind. That's another different issue.
And we're of a generation that can remember a before and after. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember my teenage years and it wasn't anything like this. And it's weird to try and reconstruct it because with hindsight, it feels odd to live in a world where the room that you're in at any given moment, unless it happened to have a telephone in it, was the limit of what you could interact with. Presumably, kids who now have always lived in this world will also have a before and after, but the after will be after this, you know, in a way that there is a huge generational divide. And I'm sure I'm guilty of this as being nostalgic for a version of what it was like to be a student in the 1980s. I'm not sure it was that much fun. I'm not sure people were that happy or any of those things. And in fact, it was quite boring and isolating because you were limited to what was in the room. You know, literally the four walls around you were the limit of your interactive capabilities. But yeah, there is a nostalgia for it because it felt calmer. So our before and after is going to be completely different from the next generation's before and after, particularly if the after is after this.
Well, I hope so. It'd be nice to think that something more authentic and healthier could be forged and that we'd learn from our experiences here. I mean, I'm not a great believer in, or at least I don't have a lot of faith in humans' capacity to learn from their experiences, but it would be good if they did. I mean, another aspect that I think is just worth mentioning when we're talking about children or young people is that when I talk to young people about social media, it's usually in the context of discussing free speech. And I think they tell me that they are frightened to say anything controversial on social media because of that potential that we've talked about for like other people to see it, unnamed others to see it, to report you, to bitch about you, to pass it on to other people, to screenshot it. You know, it's a whole new dimension to worry about. So that's another reason why I assume that they're fed up with it.
There will be more from Kathleen Stock on this series. She is also going to be talking to us later on about another bad idea, the death of the author. If you'd like to get ad-free listening and the bonus episodes that accompany The History of Bad Ideas, just sign up to PPF Plus by going to ppfideas.com or clicking on the link that comes with the episode description. You can also sign up for our free fortnightly newsletter. Coming next on The History of Bad Ideas, I'm talking to the historian Chris Clark, the Regius Professor of History at Cambridge University, about anti-Semitism. No argument that that is a bad idea, but it's a bad idea with a history, and we're going to be talking about that history, where it comes from, but more importantly, why it keeps coming back. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.